Thank you, and welcome to what looks like a great crowd here for our talk today on fusion energy with Dan Cleary, who recently came out with A Piece of the Sun, a book I would recommend you all going out and picking up when you can. Go on, I picked mine up off Amazon. It's an excellent look, I think, at how fusion is developed and is developing. Before, though, I introduce Dan, I would like to just kind of, I see a lot of familiar faces in the crowd, but some not so familiar. So just a brief background on the American Security Project and why we're interested in fusion. ASP was founded almost a decade ago as an institution to look at the big questions of national security from a fact-based, nonpartisan perspective. We were founded by a bipartisan group of senators, former politicians, and retired senior military officers, along with business people, to talk about the big issues of national security. We've been involved in energy security and climate policy since the beginning. We took up fusion about 3 or 4 years ago now to talk about the issues of kind of getting to the next generation of energy. How do we get assured energy security in an age of climate change? And I think we came down on fusion as really the energy source that checks all the boxes. Safe, secure, sustainable, and potentially economical. The only trick is we haven't yet proved it. But we think that that's a question of time and resources. And we think that the world is moving in the right direction. Dan's going to tell us about how we've gotten to where we are today in fusion research, and how he's promised some funny stories. I think it should prove to be a good background for those of you who haven't been around fusion before. And those of you who have been for a long time, and I know there's some in the audience, hopefully he'll give some good insight that some of us haven't heard. Dan Cleary is studied theoretical physics at York University in the UK. And for more than two decades, he's been editor and author for some of the world's top science magazines, including Physics World, New Science, and Science. He's been a news editor for Science Magazine since 1993. He's covered fusion pretty intimately since that time. I've followed a lot of his articles, and I'm very pleased to have him here. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan, and thank you for being here, and look forward to your presentation.
Okay, thank you. I'll stand up, if that's all right.
Sure.
Right, well, thank you all for coming on such a rainy day. As Andy said, I'm a scientist, a journalist with Science Magazine, which is based across the road, but I'm their correspondent in the UK. And for about the past 10 years, I've been covering fusion, ever since the ITER project got in a bit of a mess trying to decide where to put their reactor. And I write tons about fusion for lots of publications. So here's a few examples. My German isn't that good, but someone else helped me with that. So when I was telling people what I was doing, people that weren't familiar with the subject just seemed to know nothing about fusion. They didn't know what it was. They always associated it with cold fusion. There seemed to be a lack of knowledge about it in the wider public. So like all good journalists, I wrote a book, and which came out last year. Out in paperback this year, if you want to get it more slightly more cheaply. So one of the things that fascinated me about fusion was its great history and how politics and sometimes accident influenced that history along the way. And so I wanted to write a book that told that story in a way that, you know, anyone could understand and enjoy reading, and hopefully teach them a little bit about the physics of fusion along the way. So just to save you the trouble of reading it, I'll, you know, give you the highlights now. So where does it all start? I start the story in the 1850s when scientists were working out the laws of energy, how energy behaves, and which are called the laws of thermodynamics. The one relevant here is the first law, which says that energy can't be destroyed or created. It just can change from one form to another. It's always conserved. And it seemed to be a fundamental law that could be applied to any situation. So scientists tried applying it to lots of situations. So they took a look at the sun. How does the sun produce this amount of heat? It was fairly straightforward for them to figure out how much energy the sun was creating by looking at how much arrived at the Earth. And they could calculate the mass of the sun. So it was a prodigious amount of heat. Where was it coming from? At that time, the best source of heat they had was coal. So they calculated that if they made a sun made entirely of coal, it would only last 3,000 years. So that wasn't going to cut it as a source of heat. So these two men, Helmholtz and Thomson, came up with another idea. They said it was gravitational contraction. So as the as it shrank, this huge ball of gas, that energy was converted into heat. And that was, you know, the prevailing theory for quite a few decades. But it didn't make everybody happy. Particularly this man, who in 1859 had published The Origin of Species. When he was researching it, he looked at the world around him in Kent and looked at erosion processes and the rate of evolution, and he reckons that you would need 300 million rather than 30 million years to achieve the evolution we see today. So, the sun was too young, according to that theory. And it caused him a lot of problems. In later editions of Origin of Species, he removed that age estimate because he was so troubled by this problem of how long the sun would last. So it remained a mystery for decades. Until towards the end of the century, people started looking at, people discovered radioactivity and studied this phenomenon. These two discovered two new elements, radium and polonium, which were highly radioactive. And it was a complete mystery. They seemed to defy the first law of thermodynamics because they were always hot, they glowed in the dark, and it was just a mystery. And Marie Curie was so fascinated by radium, she used to keep pieces in her pocket to look at them in the dark and see the glow and the warmth. And still today, her lab notebooks at the time are so radioactive, you need protective clothing to handle them. Even her cookbook, apparently, you cannot handle without protection. So she died of a radiation-induced illness, which is sort of predictable. There was still this mystery. You know, the sun was a problem, radioactivity was a problem. Where was this energy coming from? So the Albert Einstein provided a solution in 1905 with special relativity. So E equals mc squared, you can produce energy from matter. So it's a sort of condensed energy, and if you can convert it, that would be a source of huge amounts of energy. But no one at the time really made the connection with the sun. But one person who did see the connection was Arthur Eddington, who was a very prominent astrophysicist in Britain at that time. And he was a great enthusiast for Einstein's theories when a lot of people dismissed it, or didn't understand it. They couldn't quite understand relativity. But Eddington thought, this was an answer to a lot of questions. And he suspected that some form of nuclear reaction powering the sun. During the First World War, he kept in contact with Einstein, which was not the done thing for British physicists at the time. But he was a pacifist and a Quaker and didn't support the war and was threatened with prison when he refused to sign up when he was called up in 1918. But other scientists made a big outcry and he was not sent to prison. But in about 1920, he made a famous speech at a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, in which he predicted that the sun was being powered by the fusion of four hydrogens into a helium. Now, another scientist, Frederick Ashton, had done an experiment where he'd measured the masses of helium and hydrogen very, very accurately. He was trying to prove the existence of isotopes. And at that time, they thought, because of the relative atomic masses, that that's what a helium was made of. It was made of four hydrogens. And if you took the masses that he measured, four hydrogens were slightly heavier than a helium. So there was a tiny bit of mass that was lost when you made that that fusion. And most people thought it was experimental error. But Eddington said this tiny amount of mass difference could provide, using E equals mc squared, the energy that powers the sun. So he predicted in his speech that this is what it was. And it, according to his calculations, he suggested that the sun was 300 billion years old, not 300 million, but billion. So plenty of time for evolution. And he prophetically said, one day maybe we will be able to use this for energy or for destruction. So quite a forward thinker. But there was a slight problem, because at that time, according to classical physics, you couldn't get two protons to get close enough together. You know, they're both positively charged. They mutually repel. The closer you get them together, the harder they repel. You just couldn't get them close enough for them to fuse together. So it was a problem. Nobody knew how to overcome that, and he didn't know. So along in the 1920s came quantum mechanics, which was a new way of looking at subatomic particles. And according to quantum mechanics, you know, you can overcome these sort of barriers. You can have quantum tunneling that allows you to overcome barriers that are apparently too high. And George Gamow was one of the scientists who first applied this theory to nuclear reactions. And he predicted that you could get hydrogens to fuse and get excess energy out, and that, you know, perhaps this was the solution for powering the sun. But so far, this was all theory. So Gamow went to Cambridge University, and he had a conversation with John Cockcroft, who's the one on the right. And Cockcroft and Walton were working on a particle accelerator, the first particle accelerator. And they, you know, were very intrigued in his idea of fusion. But their first experiments, they weren't fusion experiments. They just took protons, you know, hydrogen nuclei, and accelerated them and bombarded various materials to see what happened. When they tried this with lithium, they found they got out helium atoms, two helium atoms for each lithium that they bombarded. So what was happening was that the proton was hitting the lithium, splitting it in two, and producing two helium atoms. And they were getting out 100 times as much energy as the energy of the proton that hit the lithium at the beginning. So they'd effectively split the atom. And so, you know, they did what all good scientists do. They went out to the Eagle Pub in Cambridge and told everyone they'd split the atom. And it was in all the newspapers in a couple of days, and they won the Nobel Prize. Their boss, who was in the middle of the previous photographs, is Ernest Rutherford. There he is again, very loud and domineering chap, apparently. Anyway, he carried on their work with the other guy, if we go on again, sorry, with Mark Oliphant. Anyway, they tried some different experiments with an upgraded version of the particle accelerator, and they started trying to accelerate particles of deuterium. Now, deuterium is heavy hydrogen, so in its nucleus, it's got a proton and a neutron. And deuterium had only just been recognized its existence and only just been isolated for the first time. And the chemist in the US who did that for the first time, his first sample, he sent it to Ernest Rutherford to use. So they used that first sample of deuterium and started firing it at other things with various results. But one of the experiments they did was fire deuterium at another deuterium. And then they got two products out. One of them was tritium, which had never been seen before, which is another form of hydrogen with a proton and two neutrons. And they also got helium-3. So this was the first time fusion had been achieved rather than fission. So they had, you know, made a new atom by fusing two together. And they got 10 times as much energy out as they put in with the original deuterium. And so they showed, you know, you can get excess energy through fusion. Rutherford, however, was asked, you know, do you think this can be a power source? And he said the whole idea was moonshine. He didn't believe it would ever happen. And, you know, certainly with a particle accelerator, it wouldn't happen. You know, they just use too much energy to produce too few fast-moving particles. So he was right in a way. Anyway, next slide. So, yeah, over the next few years, we're in the 1930s by this point, a lot more was learned about how nuclear reactions come about, what sort of things like to react with other things. And towards the end of the decade, people thought, now it's time to really address what's happening in the sun. We've got enough information. We know what the reactivity of various reactions are. And so these two, Gamow and Teller, who were both Hungarian emigres, were at George Washington University. And they said, let's hold a meeting and get everyone together. So at the meeting, Hans Bethe, who was one of the leading nuclear theorists at that time, and a younger scientist, Charles Critchfield, they sat down at the meeting. Critchfield had some ideas. During the course of the meeting, which I think was like a week or two long, they worked it all out. You know, they worked out the proton-proton chain. They worked out the CNO cycle, which are the reactions that occur in the sun. So, you know, first combining hydrogen and deuterium, then working on up to make heavier elements, the first few heavy elements anyway, and worked it all out then. And Hans Bethe published a paper 6 months later, which eventually won him the Nobel Prize for working out what happened in the sun. So that's the first question from, you know, almost 100 years earlier. They answered, you know, how does the sun power itself? Next question is, you know, could you do it? Could you do it on Earth to produce energy? And some of these people had conversations about it at the time. And one scientist, Fritz Hütermann, who was German and fled the Nazis to Russia, he carried out some experiments in Kharkov, but didn't get very far because the war intervened. You know, all of these questions were not addressed anymore because people had other concerns. So, so at the end of the war, you know, the Manhattan Project has happened. Enrico Fermi, during the war, he'd made the first fission reactor in Chicago, he then came down to Los Alamos at the end of the war to give a series of lectures which he addressed the subject of thermonuclear reactions. So just looking at some of the issues if you wanted to try and achieve this in a controlled way. And this got some of the scientists there at Los Alamos thinking. You know, they did some experiments colliding particle beams to see whether you could use that as a way of producing energy. And like Rutherford suggested, it was moonshine. They couldn't get it to work, so they left it. And at that time, Los Alamos, people were leaving. You know, they had other concerns, and so they didn't follow it up. So, so there's a lot of discussion about who really started fusion research, who was the first person. And in my opinion, the first person was this man, Peter Toneman. Now, he was an undergraduate at Sydney University in Australia at the beginning of the war. And he had an idea for a fusion reactor. He thought, you know, he looked at the problem that everyone thought, how do you contain your material to make a fusion reactor? Because you have to get it very, very hot so that the fuel bang together really hard and fuse. But, you know, this has to be so hot, you know, in the tens of millions of degrees that you can't have it in a container where it's going to touch the side. So you've got to contain it in some way where it can be held without it touching the vessel that it's in. And he went at the University of Sydney in a display case. They have a piece of lead pipe. And it's crushed like that, like a giant hand has squeezed it. And this lead pipe was a lightning rod on a kerosene factory in New South Wales. And it got struck by lightning. And the owners of the factory looked at it, and it had been crushed like this. And they were so puzzled that they took it to the university and said, what could have caused this? This was around the turn of the century. And scientists there looked at it and thought about it and came up with this theory called the pinch effect. So when you have a very strong current flowing down a conductor, it creates a magnetic field, which is known, but then that current interacts with the field to push the current towards the center that it's flowing through. So essentially, if you've got a pipe, it's pushing it towards the center of a pipe. If it had been solid, nothing would have happened. But because it was a pipe, it got crushed. So he thought, if I make a plasma, this sort of, you know, very hot gas, this is, Toniman, and have it flowing down some sort of container, because it's charged particles, it's like an electric current. So it'll interact with its own field and be pinched towards the center of the tube. And that way, I can contain the plasma without it touching the sides. The problem was, what happens when you get to the end of the pipe? You know, you can't make the pipe infinitely long. So, you know, like a good physicist, he made it into a donut shape. So he had a, you know, toroidal shape, as they call them. And you just have it flowing around like that. And then it will stay towards the center of the tube. So that was his idea. He got a postdoc position at Oxford in 1946. So he got on a boat, came to the UK, came to Oxford. His supervisor wanted him to work on ion sources. But so, you know, he had to do what he said. But in the, you know, on the side, he started to do fusion experiments. After a little while, he wrote to the head of department and said, look, I've got this great idea. I think it's going to work. Can I work on a fusion reactor? And the head of department said, okay, you have to do a symposium first. So he stood up, this postdoctorate, and in front of, you know, some of the biggest minds in physics at the time at Oxford University, and described his thing. They asked lots of questions, but didn't shoot it down. So the head of department said, okay, you can start working on it. So this was, you know, 1947. He did some of the very basic work in how you get a this sort of fusion reactor to work. You know, he had the glass blowers there, make him little toruses about this big. He worked out how to make a plasma in one of those, how to get the current flowing round, because that's not a trivial task. You can't have an electrode at either end, like in a straight tube. You've got to make it flow. So he used a transformer to do that. And he started doing the work. This attracted attention from other people. John Cockcroft, one of the people that split the atom, by this time he was the head of the Atomic Energy Research Establishment. And he heard about this work. He came and looked at it, thought this is really interesting. And he said, I'll fund this research from now on and give you two assistants. So the team started to grow. But he was not the only person in the UK that had an idea for a fusion reactor. The next person, George Paget Thompson, also thought he had an idea for a fusion reactor. Now he was, you know, couldn't be more different from Toniman. He was already, you know, physics aristocracy. His father was J.J. Thompson, who discovered the electron, and he himself had a Nobel Prize for proving wave-particle duality. So he was a big cheese at Imperial College. In 1946, he had an idea for a very similar device to what Toniman was doing, but he hadn't worked out the basics as Toniman was doing. So he filed a patent. You know, he thought, I need to protect this idea. So he filed a patent, and then he went to John Cockcroft and said, we need to, you know, build a big reactor. We need to prove that this will work. Big, expensive project. Cockcroft wasn't convinced, and other people that were at those meetings weren't convinced, but they encouraged him to do some small projects at Imperial College, so he got some of his postdocs working on it. So there were two teams there in the UK. And after a few years, things took a dramatic turn because of this man, Klaus Fuchs, who was a German-born physicist who came to the UK fleeing the Nazis, and worked in the UK and then went and worked on the Manhattan Project. Then he came back to the UK after the war and was in Oxford. So he knew what Toniman was doing. When John Cockcroft had these meetings where he was discussing whether to fund Paget Thompson's idea or Toniman's idea, Fuchs was there. So he knew everything that was going on. at that time, American cryptographers cracked the cipher that the Soviet intelligence had been using during the war and after the war. And they discovered that there was a British physicist, it said, who was leaking information to the Soviets. They didn't know what British physicist, but eventually, after a few years, they narrowed it down to Klaus Fuchs. And they sent an MI5 officer to confront him, and he confessed everything. He had been a communist since his student days and thought, you know, Russia was their ally at the time. He thought they deserved to know what was happening at Los Alamos. But as a result of that, he was imprisoned for about 9 years very quickly. But as a result of that, there was a huge security clampdown on both sides of the Atlantic. So Toloman's group at Oxford, Paget Thompson's group in Imperial, they were all moved to government laboratories. Thompson's group was moved to Harwell. And so they had to carry on their work in secret, which, much to their annoyance. So that's what was happening in the UK. There's a lot of stories about what happened in the Soviet Union, that a lowly Red Army soldier, working alone, invented the tokamak that we now use in reactors all over the world. It's a good story, only some of it is true. This is the soldier, Oleg Lavrentiev. He joined up in the middle of the war before he'd finished high school, fought against the Nazis in the Baltic states. At the end of the war, he was posted to Sakhalin Island, which is in the very, very far east of the Soviet Union, which they'd captured from Japan. It was a very inhospitable place, but he was a radio telegraph operator. But it was fine for him because it gave him lots of time, because he was a physics geek. You know, he just loved physics, and he got journals and textbooks and monographs and would give lectures to his officers about technical subjects. But he completed his education. He started, you know, reading everything he could about physics. And then in 1949, just after the Soviets exploded their first atomic weapon, President Truman said, we, as a response, the United States, are going to build a hydrogen bomb, a fusion weapon. And this spurred Lavrentiev into action, and he wrote a letter to Comrade Stalin and said to him, I have worked out a design for a hydrogen bomb and a fusion reactor that could be used for industry. And he sent his letter off, waited and waited, nothing happened. So he sent the same letter to the Central Committee of the Communist Party. This time he got a very rapid response. They sent an official out to Sakhalin Island who said to him, you will come into this secure, guarded room, and I want you to write all your ideas in 2 weeks. And so Lavrentiev did that, wrote it all out in 2 weeks. It was sent off to Moscow. Very quick response. Lavrentiev was relieved of his duties in the army. He was flown to Moscow. He was enrolled at Moscow State University, where he had personal tuition from physics professors and chemistry professors. And he had his own apartment in Moscow, which is all unheard of for an undergraduate student. But the person who was looking after his interests was Lavrenti Beria, who was the most feared man in the Soviet Union. He was head of security and the KGB. But he was also in charge of the bomb project, the hydrogen bomb project in the Soviet Union. So anyway, what had happened to that document that he wrote in Sakhalin Island was he was sent, first of all, to Andrei Sakharov. Now, Sakharov was involved in the Soviet hydrogen bomb project at that time. So Sakharov looked at this plan that Lavrentiev had written out and said, and he knew immediately that the bomb wouldn't work, not because it was a bad design, but Sakharov knew things about the materials that Lavrentiev wouldn't have known. So his bomb design didn't work. Also, his fusion reactor wouldn't work. It wasn't a tokamak. It was an electrostatic trap. Sakharov realized it wouldn't work. But he thought that Lavrentiev had talent, and that's why Lavrentiev was brought over and, you know, educated in the hope that he would do other great things. But in the end, Lavrentiev didn't have a big impact on fusion in that way. He you know, when he started working at the fusion laboratory, what became the Kurchatov Institute in Moscow, everyone was suspicious of him because his patron was Lavrenty Beria, and no one wanted to be too friendly with him. So he, you know, enjoyed these privileges until Stalin died, when Lavrentiev was arrested very quickly, quickly put to death, and suddenly all his privileges disappeared. And he was just left to be an ordinary physics student. And he continued to work in fusion, but he never got his design to work. But these two, Sakharov and his mentor, Igor Tam, worked together, and they came up with this idea, which was similar to what Toneman and Paget-Thompson had thought up. You know, a toroidal vessel, but they added something else. They added a sort of a toroidal magnetic field, which sort of gives the whole plasma greater stability. And this is the device that later became known as the tokamak. So, so that design, they didn't pursue it. They handed it over to this man, who was Lev Artsimovich, who was the head of the fusion section, or he became the head of the fusion section at the Kurchatov Institute, although it wasn't called that then. And he set about, you know, developing the design. They were given, you know, huge amounts of money to develop it. They just made machine after machine, getting bigger and bigger. And again, all in secret at that time, both, you know, in the West and in Russia, it was all classified. So that's there. So what was happening in the US? You know, around that same time, not very much was happening. Physicists were interested in hydrogen bombs rather than fusion reactors. Whereas in South America, Ronald Richter, an Austrian scientist, he came to Juan Perón, the dictator of Argentina, and said, I can make unlimited energy for Argentina and for the whole world. You know, I just need some research money. So Juan Perón thought it was a great idea. And so he built him a laboratory on an island in a lake in the remote west of Argentina. He built a fusion lab, and they started working on this device called a thermotron. I have no idea how it worked, but he produced some neutrons, which is a sign that fusion reactions are happening. And then Juan Perón, in March 1951, announced to the world that they had, you know, almost mastered fusion and that it would be a great benefit to everybody. Sadly, it wasn't to be. You know, after another year, nothing much else had come out of the lab on the island, and Perón sent some Argentine physicists to investigate. They looked at what he was doing, said the temperatures were far too low to achieve fusion, and so it was all closed down, and, you know, Ronald Richter disappeared. But that headline, when Juan Perón, you know, announced that he'd mastered it, was reported all around the world. So that day in March, we have the next one, Lyman Spitzer up in Princeton was preparing to go for a skiing holiday. Now, Spitzer was an astrophysicist, and he knew all about plasmas. That was his specialization. And he was about to start work on the bomb project as a theorist, not moving to Los Alamos, but doing theory work in Princeton. And he, you know, his father rang him up and said, have you seen the New York Times? So he went and bought the paper, and he read about Juan Perón and Ronald Richter's plan, and it got him thinking. So he went to Aspen for his holiday, spent a lot of time thinking about it, going up and down on the lifts, and he came up with a design for a fusion reactor. It was not at all like the one that the others had thought up. He called it a stellarator, and it was a tube. His original one was a figure of eight shape, so it was curved at the end, but then crossed over in straight pieces, and had a different way of containing the plasma. So anyway, he came back from his holiday and said to the Atomic Energy Commission, I've got a great idea for a fusion reaction. Instead of working on the bomb, can I work on this? So they called a meeting and called him up to Washington to discuss this. Now, also at the meeting, there was another man, James Tuck. Now, he was a British physicist, and he'd been in a government advisor in Britain during the war. But then he developed shaped explosive charges for armor-piercing shells. And when the Manhattan Project needed shaped charges to make the Fat Man bomb, they asked James Tuck to come over and teach them what he knew. So he went over and worked in Los Alamos. And then he went back to the UK. He was also involved in those discussions with John Cockcroft and Klaus Fuch and George Thompson about what was happening in UK fusion. So he knew, you know, a lot about what was going on in fusion. And at this time, he was back in Los Alamos. Sorry, I don't know, I can't remember I said that. So he was called to this meeting. He wasn't impressed with the Stellarator idea. He thought the pinch idea was better. But anyway, the Atomic Energy Commission decided to give Lyman Spitzer some money. They gave him £50,000. And Tuck was a bit disgruntled by that, but he went back to Los Alamos. He finished the work he was doing, and then he persuaded the Los Alamos director to give him £50,000 to make a toroidal pinch at Los Alamos. So they ended up with two rival programs to develop a fusion reactor. And then a third program was started up. Edward Teller, who we met previously, he started up Livermore Laboratory as a second weapons lab near San Francisco. And he wanted the lab not just to be about weapons. He wanted a fusion energy program, too. So he employed Dick Post to build up a fusion energy team. Now, he didn't want to make the same thing as the others were making, a Stellarator or a pinch. So he came up with a design for what was called a mirror machine. Remember I described how if you had a long tube and you contained your plasma in a straight tube, which is a lot simpler than a toroidal tube, you had the problem what to do with the ends. So a mirror machine has a magnetic device at either end which acts as a sort of plug. So your plasma can go up and down but can't escape at the ends. So they started making mirror machines. So we ended up with three different programs going on. Now, during the late 50s and the 60s, everyone worked on all of these things in the UK, in Russia, and in the United States. And they couldn't get them to work very well. There was a problem that all of them were facing, which was that the plasma didn't stay in the middle of your container very well. It was always drifting to the edge, and so you were losing energy. It was called bone diffusion, and all the devices seemed to be suffering from it. And people were getting very frustrated throughout the 60s that this was happening. And the only people that seemed to be getting better results were the Russians with the tokamak. So they would come to international meetings. They would say, we've got this fantastic high temperature. Other people didn't believe them. At that time, it was very hard to measure the temperature of a plasma. If you think about it, you can't touch it. You know, how do you measure its temperature? Anyway, in 1968, there was a meeting at Novosibirsk, and Lev Artsimovich, who we heard about previously, he said, we've got 10 million degrees in our T3 tokamak, and everyone else was skeptical, particularly the people from Princeton. But the Cullum team, which is the British fusion center, they developed a new way of measuring the temperature of a plasma using a laser, which has not long been invented. And they said, Artsimovich asked Cullum, can you send a team over to measure the temperature? And so, Cullum agreed. And so this team was assembled to go over to Russia. Now, you've got to remember this is 1968. So it's the height of the Cold War. Kurchatov Institute is one of the most secretive places in the Soviet Union. And these people were going over there with brand new laser technology spectrometers, which are all militarily sensitive. So it was quite a feat to get this approved and organized. But they went over in 1969, spent months trying to connect their device to the U.S., the Soviet fusion reactor. And eventually they got it to work. And on a day in July, it was the day after Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, they got a clean measurement, and rang up Cullum and said, it's very, very hot. And they said, it's, like 10 million degrees. And, news of that quickly spread. And suddenly, everyone wanted to build tokamaks. They were building them all the labs. Some labs, including Cullum and Princeton, dismantled Stellarators that they were in the process of building and rebuilt them as tokamaks. So there was a great rush to build tokamaks. I can't remember what the next slide is. What is it? Ah, yeah, that's right. So we're in the early 1970s now, and Bob Hirsch became head of fusion at the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, he was a very dynamic, go-getting manager, and he thought fusion was the future. And so he pushed very hard the laboratories to keep building bigger tokamaks. And in about 1972, 73, you know, he really wanted them to build a big, big machine, one that would demonstrate break-even, you know, the point when the reactor is producing more energy than you have to put in to get it to work, which is a key demonstration that fusion is going to work as a power source. And so he got them all together. There were several proposals on the table. And another factor around this time is that the oil embargo happened in early 1973. And suddenly the government wanted alternative sources of energy. So the fusion, the funding for fusion, you know, went through the roof, you know, went really, really fast up. And suddenly there was lots of money to build fusion reactors. And so they could be suitably ambitious. Now, Harold Firth, who was a more cautious man, didn't want to start building a huge reactor, you know, straight away. He thought there were lots of things they didn't know. And in fact, they were in the process of building a quite large reactor, but it wasn't finished. They didn't know how it was going to work. And he wanted to wait until that was done to see how that performed before starting to build the next one. But Hirsch couldn't wait. And so he pushed and pushed, and eventually Princeton came up with a design that was very conservative. You know, it was big. They thought it would produce neutrons, might reach break-even. But, you know, it was not an ambitious design. And that was the one that became TFTR, Tokamak Fusion Test Reactor. Excuse me. So in Europe, similar things were happening in Europe. Now, in Europe, there was a new body created in 58 called Euratom, which was meant to coordinate research in nuclear research in Europe. It had a small fusion program led by Donato Palumbo. Now, they just sort of had the same problems everyone else was having with Bohm diffusion, couldn't get their things to work. But once tokamaks, how long is it? Oh, okay. I'm going to have to hurry. Okay. Yeah, okay. Oh, I've got the best story coming up.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, they wanted to build a big one too. So they employed Paul-Henri Rebut, who was a very charismatic scientist who just built the world's biggest tokamak in France. They employed him to design a big European tokamak that they would all contribute to. So he, in typical style, he sailed across from France to Britain in a yacht that he had designed and built himself to take charge of this research program. So in 2 years, they produced a design and presented it to Tokamak. It was to Euratom. It was entirely different. It was huge. It was ambitious. It had lots of advanced technology and very different from what TFDR was going to be like. But Euratom said fine. They trusted him. And then they had to decide where to put it. And that was a political decision. So the politicians discussed it, couldn't decide, went away. This went on for 2 years. They couldn't decide which lab to build it at. There were two contenders, but in the end, Garching in Germany or Cullum in the UK. And the scientist, Rebut and his team, who were at Cullum, that's where they'd done the design work, they were just about to give up and go home and not build a JET, as it came to be known, Joint European Taurus, when there was a dramatic event. An airliner was hijacked. This was a Lufthansa jet that was flying from Mallorca to Frankfurt, and it was hijacked by Palestinian terrorists. And they demanded that some other terrorists in Germany be freed, and they wanted $15 million. So they flew from airport to airport across the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and ended up at Mogadishu, where they said, we want our demands met tonight or we'll kill all the passengers. And they shot the pilot and dumped him out of the plane to show they were serious. So the Germans had been promising that they were getting the money and getting the prisoners together, whereas what they were really doing was tracking the plane with their special forces unit, which was newly assembled, and the GSG-9, they're called. Anyway, or that night, you know, just before the deadline, the GSG-9 stormed the plane. And they killed three of the terrorists, captured the other one, and all of the passengers were rescued with minor injuries. What does this have to do with fusion? They had advisors from the British SAS who had trained them, the GSG-9, and they provided stun grenades, which were a new technology. So these were critical, and their advice was critical in the successful ending of this hijack. And so the next day, the British Prime Minister and the German Chancellor just happened to be having a summit meeting, and the German Chancellor, Helmut Schmidt, I think, said, you know, thank you for all you have done, was his phrase. And then they sat down and they worked out a few issues of common discord, one of which was the site of the fusion reactor. So JET, because of this hijack, ended up in Culham. So you can never know what will help scientists to concentrate, help politicians to concentrate their minds. So what's next? I can't remember. Oh, yeah. Slight distraction in the late 80s with these two men and a beaker of water, but that was only a minor distraction, so we'll go on to the next one. Yes, so the big few tokamaks. We had JET in Europe, we had TFTR, there was another one in Japan and in Russia, but they didn't perform as well as expected. They had to experiment with them for more than a decade just to get them working properly. In the 90s, they got very good results. They got close to break even. You know, TFTR got to 30% of break even. JET got to 70% of break even. They were close, but they weren't there. You know, they hadn't got that breakthrough. So some people were talking about we need a bigger reactor, which is usually what happens in fusion research. If you don't succeed, build a bigger reactor. So Evgeny Velikov had become the head of the fusion project in Russia after Artsimovich died. And in the 1980s, you know, Soviet Union was not in a fit state to be a major player in fusion anymore. And it just so happened he had an old university chum who was called Mikhail Gorbachev. And Mikhail Gorbachev became premier of the Soviet Union and was a reforming kind of guy and wanted to improve relations. So Velikov went to him and said, here's a great idea, a great way to, you know, diffuse East-West tensions is we should build a fusion reactor together. And so at their first summit meeting in Geneva in 1985, they didn't talk about fusion at all, but in the long list on their communique at the right at the bottom, it said that the two nations would work together to develop fusion for all mankind. So that was how the ITER project came about. And a few years later, you know, other people joined the project. The European Union, Japan, these four partners started doing a conceptual design. Then in 1992, they got to the stage where they needed to do an engineering design, a detailed design. So who to build it? Well, Rebu had just had great triumph with JET. He was the obvious person, you know. He knew the subject, he was dynamic. Anyway, they got him over. He just threw the design out the window and built JET 2, you know, like JET, but much bigger. And he, you know, had a particular management style. People didn't like it very much, or the funders didn't like it very much. So after a couple of years, they eased him out and employed another Frenchman, Robert Aymar, who had also built a big reactor in France. And anyway, he guided the project through the 1990s. Now, they came up with a design in 1997 that was huge, you know, 22 meters across the plasma vessel, costing $10 billion. Now, at that time, late 90s in the US, Republican Revolution had happened. And this man was in charge of the Science and Technology Committee of Congress. And you know, they were determined that this was an overblown project, would never work. And so eventually, American scientists were withdrawn from the project. So America pulled out. ITER, you know, was in a bad shape. Japanese economy had also gone a bit pear-shaped. So the partners didn't know what to do. So they decided to develop a simpler design. They reduced the goals, they made it smaller, they made it cheaper. They came back in 2002 with a design that was 16 meters across, cost $5 billion. And everyone seemed happy with that. So we got the US rejoined in 2003, China joined, South Korea joined. Suddenly, you know, they were on a roll. So we get to Washington in 2003, and they had to decide where to put it. It's that perennial problem. Where do you put your international project? So there were two on the table. There was Rocacho in Japan and Cadarache in France. And six partners, obviously they split down the middle, couldn't agree. And so, you know, we had the same situation as with JET. You know, for all 18 months, there was, you know, political wrangling, accusations flying back and forth. It was very ugly. And scientists wondered whether the project would ever happen. Eventually, Europe won the day. They made major concessions, both monetary and otherwise, to win ITER. And so ITER was built in Cadarache. So in 2006, the project was formed, the ITER organization. Now, sadly, the ITER organization was created by a group of diplomats. And the management structure was a disaster. So these two men, who had the misfortune to be the director general of ITER, first Akita and then Motojima, you know, it's been a real struggle. You know, the redesign took ages because there are so many cooks trying to make the broth. And the cost has gone through the roof, as we all know. And the start date has been pushed back. 2016 was the original date, 2018, 2020, and nobody now believes that 2020 is achievable. So we don't know what the date is going to be for the start of ITER, but, you know, it's a very difficult open question. So that's where we get to the mess we're in now. You know, there was a very scathing management review very recently, which I wrote about. And now, you know, the United States is seriously thinking about whether they can afford to be part of it. If, you know, these budget figures they're projecting now are realistic, it's going to cost an awful lot more than people originally thought. So, you know, the ITER project has a long history. It's at a critical stage. You know, it could go wrong, but hopefully, you know, these people, the 500 staff who are there in Cadarache, hopefully they will be the people to prove it can be done, as long as we can support them long enough. So, thank you very much.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes, but I'm gonna take the opportunity to ask the first question, then we might have time for one more. I'm struck throughout by this, how science intersects with politics. Mm. You know, you talk about the location choices, you talk about decisions to move forward and everything like that. And maybe even politics gets involved even more as they've gotten bigger and more costly and everything like that. And I want to say, first of all, that the U.S. can afford it. It's just whether we're going to choose to pay for it.
Yes.
We have the money. There's plenty of money available for it. It's just whether we want to choose to spend it on that or other things. So I guess the question is, how do you either get, you're never going to get politics out of it. Nor should you. So what you need to do is get politics involved and supportive. And when has politics worked in the 20 years or 10 years you've been looking at this and everything? When has politics worked, and what are the lessons we can take from that?
Yeah. I think the time when politics really worked was in the 1970s, when there were the oil crises, because then energy or alternative sources of energy became a very important part of government policy. And, you know, the recent management report, and I was in Princeton yesterday talking to people there, Princeton Fusion Lab, And they were saying that there's a lack of a sense of urgency. That was what so many people said to me. Where is the urgency? You know, no one seems to think this is something we need, and we need it now. And until there is a sense of urgency that fusion could solve this problem, I don't see that politics is going to get really behind it. And so there needs to be something not connected to fusion to make fusion the solution to it. And you know, until we have that, I don't know whether your politicians are going to get behind it.
I'm going to take three questions here. So one, two, three, we'll go just like this way, and then wait for the microphone up here first, Kathy. Mark first, and then.
Thank you. Question, what's your opinion about the trend line, if you will, about U.S. Stature in the world fusion community?
Why don't we wait and get them all at once?
Oh, okay, okay.
Since we're almost out of time.
Sort of comment, a quick question. Of course, the comment is, you know, and going through all the faces is, it's interesting to try to chart how many of them said it's 20 years away.
Yes.
Going back 50 years, because 70-80% of the faces you showed said 20 years.
Yes.
So there's that. But a different angle, if you look at like Robert Hirsch and there are a number of companies that are pursuing, private firms and governments that are pursuing fusion at the small size, where ITER is at, you know, 20 to 50 billion plus. Mm. There are others who are starting to claim they can be doing it for 20, 50 million. A perspective on the small ones.
Yes.
Perhaps.
And one more back here, and then I'll let you answer.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wondered if you had an observer's assessment of whether this or some of these smaller ones he just mentioned will ever work.
Yeah.
I mean, can they get there? That's why I came today.
Okay. You're going to have to remind me of the questions now.
So can it work?
Oh, yeah, status of the U.S. I think scientifically, you know, fusion scientists in the U.S. are respected everywhere. What, you know, frustrates people in other parts of the world is the funding process, you know. So having to have annual approvals for everything, and so you never know what the funding level is going to be, that's a major frustration for other people. You know, I don't know whether that could ever be solved, but in other countries, you know, they have longer timelines, and they don't always get a lot of money, but at least they know how much they're going to get for a certain set period of time, which is usually longer than 1 year. Interesting, you said everyone always says it's 20 years ahead. 30 years is the thing. So what was
the small ones.
Okay, yeah. Well, the reason tokamaks have dominated is because they showed the best properties. You know, there are lots of other types of fusion reactor, but tokamaks showed a path that you could go forward. You know, they have a thing called scaling laws. So if you build a number of tokamaks, you can see what happens when you make a tokamak bigger or smaller or wider or taller, and whether that improves it. And the scaling laws always show bigger is going to provide better containment. And so hence reactors get bigger as they want to achieve better results. Now, these plethora of little projects, you know, they're less well developed because it's quite hard to do the project. You can do a lot of theory, which suggests that it'll work, but when you actually build the thing, they seldom work as you had forecast. You know, plasma is a nonlinear material, and it's very, very hard to simulate how it's going to behave in a certain situation. So saying whether any of the, you know, they're long shots. They're not impossible, these little devices that people are making, but you know, they need luck to work, and maybe one of them will, and that would be fantastic for everybody. You know, stellarators, which were sort of disappeared for a while after tokamaks came along, people still build them, and you know, we have one half built at Princeton, which lost its funding a few years ago. But you know, they may play a major role. You know, they solve some of the problems that tokamaks have, so you may end up with something that's part tokamak, part stellarator. You know. So other approaches shouldn't be dismissed, but fusion scientists have tended to put their money on the one that showed the best promise, which is tokamaks.
And then the last question is, will it work? Do you think it'll work? You've been around.
Yeah.
You've spent enough time in this.
I have. Well, I'm not a fusion scientist. I don't you know, I can't say scientifically, but I would be very surprised if ITER does not achieve break-even. You know, I think it will get gain, it'll make excess energy, but that's not the end of the story. You know, no power utility is ever going to want ITER on the grid. It's just a monstrous machine that's too complicated and too expensive to run. So they're going to want something simpler and reliable, something that can run for 30 years without much maintenance and can be run by, you know, technical people. So that's the challenge then, you know, making it work reliably, making materials. You know, there are a lot of material questions because it's a very hostile environment inside the vessel that haven't been answered. And they haven't been answered because fusion doesn't get enough funding. You know, people have plans to test all of these things but have been unable to do so yet.
And that's the trick. We have to move it from a science experiment to an engineering problem and start to figure out the solutions to the engineering problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that takes political will and some funding,
which
we're trying to work on, and we hope you all will as well. And thank you all for coming. Take a look on our website for more work on fusion. Take a look for our Fusion Power 10-year plan. Which advocates significantly more funding than we're getting. And thank you all for coming.